Can you guess who is the subject of Great Lives today? The sound of tapping feet. And there's one person who comes to mind when you hear that. Of course, it's Fred Astaire. Dancer, singer, actor and choreographer, he was a child performer, a vaudeville star, a toast of Broadway and a Hollywood box office hit. He was born Frederick Austerlitz on the 10th of May 1899 in Omaha, Nebraska, and died on the 22nd of June 1987. It would have been his birthday, his 110th this month.
Drop that long face, come on, have your fling. Why keep nursing the blues? If you want this old world on a string, put on your dancing shoes, stop wasting time. Put on your dancing shoes, watch your spirits climb.
Fred Astaire singing the George Gershwin title song of the film Shall We Dance, released in 1937. And who, as my guest today, has chosen him? A dancer? A singer? An actor? A pop star? No, a GP, son of a GP, a medical writer, one-time member of the General Medical Council, but in later years, a broadcaster and novelist too. Michael O'Donnell, whose sometimes sceptical and iconoclastic approach towards his own profession has brought him controversy and media prominence in equal measure, has made hundreds of radio and television programmes, and on Radio 4 was the last chairman of My Word, the presenter of Relative Values, and a regular contributor to Stop the Week. Ah, those long-lost days of Stop the Week. Among his books, my favourite title from a long list is Doctor, Doctor, An Insider's Guide to the Games Doctors Play. Michael, you're not a foot specialist, a physio, a film critic or a musician, so why Fred Astaire?
I think the answer is in the music you just played, because I found it really moving, just even the tapping feet, and because it carries me back to the heart of a very happy childhood that I was granted. And my parents used to take me to the cinema. I grew up in the South Yorkshire coalfield, as it's now called, in the 1930s, fairly depressing times, and was there during the war when the bombers were coming over. But my only windows on the world were the cinema screens in Doncaster. And I used to go there with them, and it was nearly always Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, because they were great fans. And I actually believed this was another world that existed. I thought this was real. I thought, you know, maybe somewhere south of Doncaster, there were people who were lounging around in evening dress and in hotel rooms with extraordinarily high ceilings, with huge French windows that opened out onto white balconies, marble and balustrades, and so, or people dancing up and down them. I really thought that it existed. I wasn't all that keen on Ginger Rogers, but Fred Astaire, he just became a magical figure in this child's life.
Do you enjoy dancing yourself?
My family laugh at any thought of me dancing, and I had no aspirations to be a dancer. I mean, when I was a kid, the only way you could get to touch a girl was to dance, and I used to have to go to dancing lessons, but I used to just grab hold of a girl, and she would get rid of me quite quickly, battered and bruised. So I had no interest, but I was just fascinated by the man.
I'm not a natural Fred Astaire devotee, but I find your enthusiasm quite infectious. Here's a song that really captures that world that you describe, the fantasy world, where everything is fine. Isn't this a lovely day?
The weather is brightening, the thunder and lightning seem to be having their way. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a lovely day. The turn in the weather will keep us together, so I can honestly say that as far as I'm concerned, it's a lovely day. And everything's okay.
Take you back, Michael.
It's a measure of the reality I found in it when I was a child. That when I went to London for the first time, about the age of 21, I think, I was terribly disappointed that the little rotunda bandstand in which that song was sung and which he and Ginger had danced didn't actually exist. I went looking for it. First time I've ever admitted it.
We have a Fred Astaire expert in the studio today, but before I introduce her, I'm pleased to welcome Fred Astaire's own daughter, Ava Astaire Mackenzie. Ava, did your father really inhabit the fantasy world that Michael imagined as a boy?
No, he didn't. But I think he would have liked that, to have that bandstand really exist in London, because he loved London. And I'm sure, actually, that he was rather disappointed that they didn't make that film on location, because he'd spent so many years here when on the stage with my aunt in his earlier career, and London was always a great favorite of his. But that could have been the fantasy world, maybe.
Ava Astaire Mackenzie is the second child of Fred and Phyllis Astaire. She hasn't flown in from Beverly Hills to be with us because she left the US in 1975 for Ireland with her painter husband Richard Mackenzie, moving into a 200-year-old farmhouse on the south coast. Since then, she's established an enviable lifestyle, digging potatoes and writing about her passion for good food and life in Ireland. But such a contrast, Ava, to the world, or at least the image conjured up by your father.
Well, yes, it is. I grew up in Beverly Hills, so I've experienced quite a contrast in my life as well.
Did he love Ireland too? And can you imagine him in another life, leading the sort of life you do?
Well, he loved Ireland by his association of being there with my Aunt Adele, because she lived, when she was Lady Charles Cavendish, at Lismore Castle in County Waterford, and he really, really enjoyed visiting her. However, when he made a film on location in Ireland, a film called The Purple Taxi, he was anxious to be in Ireland, not accounting for the fact that it was going to be winter. He wasn't going to be living in a castle. It was a film location, and he came down to visit us in our house and actually slept in his clothes because he was so cold.
Let's talk about Astaire's epic career, spanning over 70 years, and bring in our expert, Dr. Kathleen Riley. And another surprise, because Kathleen's no tap-dancing celeb chaser at all, but a British Academy postdoctoral fellow in classics at Oxford. She's also a postdoctoral research associate of the Archive of Performances of Greek and Roman Drama. But, and this is her cue for today, she's at work on a history of the stage career of Fred and Adele Astaire, and contributing to a new volume for the Oxford University Press, The Ancient Dancer in the Modern World, a chapter entitled A Pylades for the 20th Century, Fred Astaire and the Aesthetic of Bodily Eloquence. She's even organised the only ever international conference at Oxford on Astaire's life and legacy. Kathleen, you and Ava have, I presume, met before?
Yes.
Oh, indeed we have.
Your old friends.
She's been to visit us in Ireland.
Yes, and Ava and her husband Richard were our special guests at the conference in Oxford last year.
On the face of it, as a scholar of classics at Oxford, you don't seem to be a very likely candidate to be an expert on one of the greatest musical comedy stars of the 20th century. Where's the link?
Well, there isn't really a link. It's just that Fred is my first love. I literally can't remember a time when I didn't know about him, so I came to him very young. I think, luckily, because I was of a generation that grew up watching old black and white films on television of a Saturday afternoon. And I had no interest in dancing per se, and I certainly can't dance myself, like most of us around this table, I think. But I see Fred not so much as a dancer, actually. I mean, that's quite obvious. But I see him as a consummate storyteller and dramatist and a supreme musician. And I can't think of another dancer that I find endlessly compelling in the same way.
George Balanchine, who was a sort of guru of modern dance at the time, he did describe him as the most interesting, most inventive and most elegant dancer of that time.
Yes.
So that, I mean, that's something I came to, I mean, I gushed away like a fan. But when the more I learnt about him, the more I became attracted by the work that he did. And I quite understood why Balanchine would say that. I'm now at the stage, really, where just as if I'll go to a concert, if a bardo is conducting, don't mind what the programme is, I just think a bardo adds something to the music that appeals to me. In the same way, if I see there's a Fred Astaire film, not any of the dramas, but a film in which he dances, is on television, I will stay in or I will record it. And I'm still addicted to it in exactly the way as I'm addicted to a Bardot's conducting. So slightly more than gushing fan, I think.
Balanchine actually likened Fred to Bach, and he said he was the only male dancer that he could watch, really. You know, we think of Fred as a musical comedy star and inhabiting that world you were speaking of, Michael. But he was also a supreme artist, although it was not a role that he himself aspired to. He was very self-deprecating in that respect. And if asked what were his ambitions or his artistic aspirations, he would always say, "I was just there to make a buck," or which we know wasn't really true, because the amount of work that he put in, he could have got away with much less work and the results would still have been supreme. But, I mean, his perfectionism is legendary.
I'm struck by a word both of you have used. Obviously, his perfectionism is legendary. Obviously, he was a superlative dancer, but you've both said that he was an interesting dancer. What do you mean by that, Kathleen?
Well, I think he was quite unusual, certainly in the field of popular dance, in that he made use of the whole body, which was particularly unusual for a tap dancer, that he would use the upper body. He knew how to use his hands very expressively, and he was concerned all the time to tell a story through dance, even if the plot in which he was dancing, the libretto or the film script, was quite slight. The stories that he could tell, which are mostly love stories, particularly the duets, absolutely rich in psychological complexity. He's telling you the whole story of a character at the same time. So that's what I mean when I say he's a master dramatist.
Arthur, how did your father start out?
He started out tagging along after my Aunt Adele, because she was the one that was the dancer, and she was a year and a half older than he. And she had to go to dancing class, and there was no one to mind him, so along he went. And developed an interest at that point when, I mean, his first performance was when he was four and a half years old, in vaudeville and, you know, on the stage.
Was he brought up in prosperous circumstances?
No, not at all. My grandmother was a school teacher, and she, of course, was the consummate stage mother in the long run. I mean, she did run their careers and I think was extremely ambitious. She was a very, very beautiful woman and very prim.
Tell me, Kathleen, how he and Adele got really launched. What sent them into orbit?
It was actually, they were stars on Broadway to some extent. When their first big musical in which they had a very good role was For Goodness Sake in 1922 on Broadway. But what really made them stars was coming over here to London in 1923 with the same show, which was then called Stop Flirting. They changed the title for the London version. I really can't think of anything comparable apart from Lindbergh, the sort of celebrity that they attained. They were just huge.
And she was the bigger star.
Absolutely.
That's a really interesting, which not many people know, but she was the one in those days, to the degree that when she left the stage to marry, my father thought his career was over.
Are they by this stage going under the name of Astaire? Oh, when was Austerlitz dropped?
My grandmother, she changed the name to Astaire and took the aus from Austerlitz,
yes,
and the air part from an Aunt Claire that she liked. Now, I'm not sure who Aunt Claire was, but that's what my grandmother
it's
said.
It's such a brilliant name, Astaire, and I don't know whether it's just a brilliant choice of sound so that it has the sort of refinement and elegance that one associates with him, or whether the name Astaire, in a sense, has now become so associated with that it just sounds classy, doesn't it?
Yes, I would vote in favour of the classiness comes from him, really. There was an aesthetic quality about his work that he was probably unaware of.
I hate to introduce a note of rancour into all this sunshine, but, Kathleen, you've written that Fred was the workhorse and worrier, a moaning mini to his sister's good time Charlie. Is it fair to call him a moaning mini, or indeed your aunt a good time Charlie, Arthur?
I think it probably is fair. He was always, we're back to the word perfectionist, but the work really, really had to be exactly as he wanted it. And when he was making the film, again, the Purple Taxi, if the work had not gone well that day, he complained about the food at night. And I remember so well him saying, these pork chops are really tough. Work hadn't gone well that day. Mm. Same pork chops the next night. Gosh, these are awfully good pork chops. Work had gone well that day.
It was niggling him in some way.
He found it very hard work, and it really made him cross when someone would say, gee, that looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And he said, it was a job. It was hard. He definitely felt that way.
Even the singing, it didn't look as though he was trying to sing. And I'm sure the same amount of work went into that.
I wanted to ask you, all about the singing. There was that infamous screen test about which it was written of him, can't sing, balding, also dances.
I think it also said can't act, didn't it?
Did it?
I personally believe that quote's apocryphal. I can't believe even a Hollywood mogul was that stupid. But he himself was very aware of his limited vocal range of the instrument at his disposal. And yet so many jazz singers or great singers in popular music, Sinatra, Crosby, Tony Bennett, they all cite him as a huge influence. And all the great songwriters, of course, composed especially for him, Gershwin, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, and all said that he was their favourite interpreter of a song.
And yet these days, the name Astaire, immediately people say dance, and then the next thing they say is Ginger Rogers. The singing, and he was a very important influence in his century, seems to have been forgotten a bit.
Well, except my jazz musician son said to me, I told him I was doing this programme, and he said, you know, he made some marvellous recordings with Oscar Peterson of jazz singing.
He really did enjoy singing, and he loved writing songs. He wrote something like 40 songs.
Did he sing and dance at home? Did he sing to you as a father? Or dance for you as a father?
He didn't really dance around the house at all. As a joke, he might do it. I remember him waking me to go to school one morning and doing a little dance step. But he just, I guess, thought it would be amusing. I'd hear him singing because he would be sometimes composing, or he loved to sing, and he had a piano in his room and would sit at it and play and sing sometimes.
It was a happy marriage.
My mother was not a Hollywood person at all. She was from the East Coast and from a more or less social background, and she didn't like California very much. She didn't like the movie business. In fact, the two of them were very, very quiet and didn't attend a lot of parties and that sort of thing. But sadly, my mother died after they'd been married about 20 years, and it was the most devastating thing that ever happened to him.
No one seems to have had a bad word to say about him, and you can't look at the man or listen to him without feeling a sort of warmth and niceness in a not boring sort of way. How did he manage, just by the way he looked, the way he spoke, the way he sang, the way he danced, how did he manage to convey this immense pleasantness and niceness and yet be sharp and clever at the same time? Can any of you put your finger on it?
I can say, first of all, that he really was very nice. And most important of all, which isn't exactly part of your question, but it's important for me to say, he was a wonderful father. He had to take over my upbringing. I was 12 when my mother died, and being in a desperately sad situation himself, had to do an incredible job, and he was wonderful.
Michael,
now somebody else can maybe put their finger on your real answer to the question.
I wouldn't try to put it into words. I'd just play you a DVD of one of the song and dances, and there's the answer.
I think one of his favourite songs for you, Michael, is After You, Who? So let's listen to that.
After you, who could supply my sky of blue? After you, who could I love? After you, why should I take the time to try? For who else could qualify? After you, who hold my hand and swear you'll never cease to care. For without you there, what would I do?
You're listening to Great Lives. Today's subject is Fred Astaire, chosen by Michael O'Donnell. And we have his daughter, Ava Astaire McKenzie, and the expert Kathleen Riley to help us talk about him. After You, Who? That was written by Cole Porter and performed by Fred Astaire in 1933, wasn't it, Michael?
I don't know when it was performed, but I'm delighted you found it, because it is the one song that conjures up for me, not just him, but the whole, it conjures up my childhood and recently has taken on an even greater significance for me. I'm so pleased you found it.
I see your eyes filling with tears when playing. And his career on this side of the Atlantic proceeded apace with his career on the other side, did it, Kathleen? He was always and more famous here.
Well, certainly in the 1920s, he and Adele spent half the decade here, and they were huge stars here. I mean, they were great friends with the then royals, particularly the Prince of Wales and his younger brother, Prince George, Duke and Duchess of York, and lots of literary figures like George Bernard Shaw, J.M. Barrie, Hugh Walpole, even A.A. Milne and Christopher Robin. They were all sort of groupies of the Astaires. So they had
Twiggy, apparently.
Yes, that's right. They had an extraordinary social and cultural impact as well as artistically.
Ava, maybe you can confirm or deny this, but that there's a story that he went racing and the Queen was with him. And he said to the Queen, "I danced with your mother, you know." And the Queen replied to him, "Oh, you mean she danced with you."
I think the story's true.
Very witty reply. Let's talk a little bit about the second half and the end of his career. He had a great many, positively, his last performances, didn't he, Arthur?
Well, not a great many. He did retire when I was a little girl. He decided he wanted to just live a quiet family life.
He'd made a huge amount of money, I imagine, had he?
Well, they didn't make that much money in those days. I just remember how furious he was when one of the stars, when he obviously was in his later years, got $1 million for a film, because he never got anything like that. But
I just assumed that he was fabulously wealthy.
No. I mean, he didn't want for much, but he certainly was not fabulously wealthy. He did retire, but was brought out of retirement to replace Gene Kelly when Gene broke an ankle, and to play opposite Judy Garland in Easter Parade. In my recollection of growing up, he was always looking forward to a new project, getting an idea for a dance.
For you, Michael, as a self-confessed devotee, did you want him to go on and on, or did you hope that he would go out on a high note and not fade away?
The thought never crossed my mind, really. The phase that Arva was just talking about, our sort of post-1946 around about then, was there I became a much more enlightened watcher of the films, and they were marvellous films from then on, right through. Bandwagon came after that, I think, didn't it, all those. And then the film's called That's Entertainment, where he did bits with Gene Kelly,
yes,
were magnificent. And so I just assumed, being young-ish then, that life just went on.
Did he maintain his agility into old age as a dancer, Kathleen?
Well, I mean, he had an extraordinary longevity for a dancer. That's Entertainment too, which you mentioned, where he did do a little bit of dancing, he and Gene Kelly. When you look at that, he was, 78 then?
Do you think there's a modern-day Astaire for today's recession, someone who can just breathe optimism and cheerfulness through the economic gloom?
I think he's definitely a one-off. And artistically, I think the revolution he wrought on film is not one we've built on. It's all been lost. I think you look at a modern-day musical, or what purports to be a musical film, they're deeply unsatisfying to anyone who grew up watching Fred Astaire because of the cuts, the editing and so forth. But apart from that, I think that special quality of Fred's, what I would liken to F. Scott Fitzgerald's description of America as a willingness of the heart, I don't think that sort of new world optimism, that sheer joyfulness that he inspired, I can't see that really anywhere, not to the same extent.
Do you think that his work will survive, Michael, into the next generation? You remember him first time round, but slowly people who remember him first time round are dying. Will the work on celluloid and recorded stand in its own right without the age that sort of put the wind into its sails?
I think a lot of the films will survive because they are unique. Other films have copied the thing, but nobody has captured the quality of it. So I think that isolated ones will survive. When you ask about, will there be somebody who can bring the same cheerfulness or uplifting feelings that we need in the recession, I don't think it won't happen in film, because it happened in film then because film was a social occasion. Whole towns went to the cinema because there was no television. And I don't know that television can bring people together because they're all sitting in isolation.
Arva, we can't ask him because he isn't here. You're the closest thing we have. If he were to have his life again, did you as his daughter sense that he regretted anything about the way he'd lived his life, or that there was anything he would like to have done differently, or been that he wasn't?
Well, I do know that he would have loved to have had a really, really big hit song that he wrote. Mm. That was the one thing I think he regretted, was that he wasn't a really successful songwriter.
It's so fascinating with Arva here, because there was a life there behind it all that I'm more and more aware. One of the reasons for wanting to do this programme and putting him forward as a great life is to find out more about him, because there's so much gossip around and sort of showbiz froth about him. I've learned what to discard. There are two Fred Astaires in my mind. The Fred Astaire of my childhood, who evolved into the artist that I recognised in my adulthood. And they're both there still.
You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to my guests, Michael O'Donnell, Arva Astaire McKenzie and Kathleen Riley. And to finish, let's hear another of Fred's songs, written by Irving Berlin from 1936, another favourite of yours, I believe, Michael, which tells us that although there may be trouble ahead, while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and, well, dance.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.